So up next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, if you can get it, or if you can't, try the archives on the HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website at HUFSantaCruz.org under Latest Lost Shows. We're not lost, but we are the latest, and this is October 21st, if you're listening to it on Thursday night when it's aimed at. I'm doing this on Thursday afternoon. And you're going to be hearing an interview with the former city council member and activist Micah Posner, activist with the Santa Cruz Community Credit Union customer base, rather than with anybody in the officialdom there, trying to stop the board of directors' sellout of the building to a New York bank, as he describes it, unsuccessful, but also concerned with the further gentrification of the downtown area. That's particularly significant, at least particularly the Santa Cruz Community Credit Union sellout, because that whole block, including the Food Not Bombs parking lot, is about to be turned into some kind of Cynthia Matthews-initiated development plan for, I have to say it, it looks like the well-to-do. And you'll also be hearing on the other end of the scale from Monica Martella, who is a Petaluma activist who's, I was finally able to reach up in Petaluma, having heard that the activists themselves, I should say the plaintiffs, homeless folks, unhoused people, had themselves forced with a threatened eviction from the encampment, the survival encampment they were in Steamer Lane Park, I think it was called. I'll check that out when she talks about it. We're able to get together an injunction that stopped it without using an attorney. I think they used some legal support. And I'm still trying to get a hold of plaintiffs to talk about it. I haven't yet done that. And I'll keep trying. In the meantime, you'll get to hear her account. She's very involved, although I guess at a distance. Well, in fact, she was going to meet somebody who was either a plaintiff or a friend of a plaintiff. When I got a hold of her on the phone, it's a horrible connection, but I'm still going to play it anyway because I've been trying so hard to reach her, and I finally got through to her. And then also, I'll be playing a flashback, which I'll be describing later in the show. And who knows, other bits and pieces, so stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So I'm going to begin by reading a link of an account that Wes White of the Monterey County Homeless Advocates posted actually just about 6 hours ago as I do this on Thursday afternoon. It's an account by someone named Tanya Diaz, and it's about Sergio Gonzalez, who I think I mentioned in an earlier post from Wes White regarding his death in the Monterey County Jail. I'm going to read this account so that because I know nothing about it other than what I'm reading here, but here is what I'm reading. This is why we're pushing for the recognition of the infractions that occurred here in regards to the unlawful death of Sergio Guzman Gonzalez on September 24th, 2021. This is a negligence and disrespect in regards to the state-mandated COVID-19 rules, regulations, policies, and procedures. This county has not abided, that's Monterey County, by any of those mandates. They have disregarded. They have had deputies come in, do counts numerous times without gloves, without donning stations for the decontamination of their boots. They've rifled through our stuff. They've searched our stuff without gloves, not wearing their masks properly. The other day they came in and did a raid in here. They put us all on the ground at 7:45 in the morning with no shirts, no socks. They put us in an 11.5 by 24 and 12-foot room, 40-plus people. They weren't promoting social distancing. They weren't giving us masks until I started requesting the mask because I'm diabetic. I'm a high risk. At this point, we just recently discovered that Monterey County Jail proclaimed that Sergio Guzman Gonzalez's death was a suicide, which is all wrong. We're asking that at this point, this Monterey County Jail forward any and all data and information pertaining to Sergio Gonzalez to be rendered from the dates of January to September 24th that would actually show this man's capable endurance to be able to work out. Some people have known him for 20-plus years. They've known him to be a motivated physical workout partner that has nothing but great health conditions, and he was COVID sick. He was placed on quarantine for only 6 days with 7 other members, a total of 8 that got quarantined. They were brought back 6 days later, which mandate states that it should be 14 to 21 days of quarantine. That was not done. They brought them back. They say, hey, they're all contaminated anyway, deal with it, is what the actual slogan was from one of the deputies. At that point, infringing and endangering each and every person's lives in here, and that was a high risk. This was a big no-no. At this point, that's what should be highlighted, the simple fact that the commander has not been answering grievance forms that we've been putting in. They hadn't. They didn't come in here and do a building. They just put us all back in together. I myself personally got put in a dormitory where we were being cross-contaminated. There's a number of infractions here that I can go on forever just in the simple time that I've been here since September. Not provided us with the proper masks. They've given us paper masks instead of the N95s or the KN95s when in the lobby it states they're mandated and they're required. So there's many more things that to shake and grind. I have a whole bunch of a number of infractions. I have maybe 2 pages worth from their own manual that they have, an inmate manual book they don't even render us. I had to find it through one of our inmates. They had a book from a long time ago, which is still outdated. They took off the memorandum board where their number for lawsuit lawyers in the state. And it's signed an inmate in Monterey County Jail. And at the end of this account, attention, Facebook family and friends, if any one of you knows or has someone in the Monterey County Jail, please continue to read and pass the word on. And this is what I put up at the Thursday show, I believe. Or maybe it was at the last Sunday show. On Tuesday, October 19th, the inmates are going to do a hunger strike for those who have passed away. It was the Sunday show. From COVID, like a good friend from Greenfield, Sergio Guzman Gonzalez. Shaggy, as most of us knew him then. This is Tanya. Her call to action is call at the Monterey County Jail. Protest outside Juvenile Hall from 8 to 9 and 6 to 7 on Tuesday. Call the front desk at 755-3782, though I don't know what the area code is. The jail is going on hunger strike. Let's protest in solidarity. We are protesting cruel and unusual punishment, violation of due process, state-mandated COVID regulatory health and safety violations, and the death of Sergio Gonzalez. Say his name, Sergio Gonzalez. Navidad y Chaparral in front of the Monterey County Jail on October 19th. And, of course, it's now October 21st. And if you go to Monterey County Homeless Advocates, you'll find more postings and pictures of the actual strike outside or the outside support group for the strike, YouTube postings. I suspect that these were posted by Wes White, or at least he might well have done this on his John Doe 13K website. And as I look at this, yeah, John Doe 13K, if you want to follow the protests against the death of Sergio Guzman Gonzalez, in terms of, I guess, mainly negligence and disregard in regards to state-mandated COVID-19 rules, regulations, policies, and procedures. And here are some of the voices from outside. There's actually more than an hour of videotape, and that's far more, not dramatic. It might be, if you want to catch it, check it out on YouTube at John Doe 13K.
They took off the memorandum board with their numbers for lawsuit lawyers and the state.
He was calling me like literally like dying.
He was dying.
It's been a lot of anxiety for myself also, knowing that he's just dying there on his bunk, you know.
His bunk, he just passed away.
I called medical. I called commanders. I called everybody. You know, they still didn't. They didn't go check on him. They didn't do nothing for him. And as I like I said, he was Sergio's. They slept next to each other.
Yeah.
It was his bunkie, and until this day, they still haven't even.
And I told him put in six.
Until this day,
put in grievance, put in six slips. You know, I've been in jail for a long time ago.
So we called, like, you know, you put in medical slips, called, you recorded, and they're just being neglected. You know. And it's not fair because, you know, at the same time, we're living in, we're living with them, you know, because we can live our video chats all day long, so. And like I said, they could get those videos back, like he was calling, telling me that he's dying, he can't breathe, he can't move, he can't get up, you know?
No
pills. And I'm calling, nothing.
That's
sick also, they were
real bad.
You know, I'm sitting here on the phone watching him die, like, they're watching him die, like.
Let's jump up to Novato in Sonoma County. Here's a press release issued by the California Homeless Union, statewide organizing council, and here's what it says. In the case of Marin County Homeless Union versus City of Novato, Federal Judge Yvonne Gonzalez Rogers this afternoon, that was October 18th, issued a preliminary injunction permitting Camp Compassion to remain in place in Lee Garner Park, while also prohibiting the City of Novato from enforcing ordinances numbers 1669 and 1670. The challenged revisions to the Novato Municipal Code enacted in June would have essentially banned camping everywhere in the city deemed to be near, quote, critical infrastructure, which could have been anything from overhead electrical wires to buried pipelines. This is the latest in a string of victories for the California Homeless Union, said Union General Counsel Anthony D. Prince. It was our officers and members, as well as experts in public health, coming forward with evidence, declarations, and a willingness to testify that pushed the city into agreeing to this order. In the end, the city blinked and agreed to jointly stipulate to ruling. An evidentiary hearing scheduled for this Wednesday, October 20th, has been taken off the calendar, said local union presided a president, Jason Saris. That's what he said. This injunction is what we needed to feel safe and avoid criminalization. The underlying civil rights case will now move to the next stage while the city implements improved conditions and guaranteed vital services to the campers. And there is a press conference and solidarity rally that was announced for day before yesterday, 10 a.m., Camp Compassion at Lee Garner Park, Lake Gurner Park, Novato Boulevard, and 7th Street, if you know Novato. And I will hope to have some more audio on this, perhaps from Jason Saris, who is, I guess he's posted this copy of the injunction, or possibly I can read in more detail from it when I have a more convenient copy of it, when I do the show on Sunday, which is a longer show and gives me more time. And it looks like I missed an event happening because it wasn't posted where I would have seen it on D-Bay, come on guys, or sent out an email where I would have read it, for the Empty Home Tax, a campaign launch party, was last Saturday, October 16th, at the Shanty Shack Brewery on Fern Street. Sounds like they want to pressure the state party, I don't know about that, to support renters, not just affordable housing, which mainly addresses adding supply as rates skyrocket while wages don't. This is how we get things done. Well done, Santa Cruz. I don't know about pressuring the Democrats. That didn't seem to have been too successful in moving to defund the police here in Santa Cruz, in spite of massive outcry last summer. And here's some good news from Marin County, which I may have mentioned in the previous show. Marin Harbor Master tasked with seizing illegal Richardson Bay boats, set to resign. Story by Ann Weinstein from October 8th in the San Francisco Chronicle. Curtis Havel, or Havel, not sure how he pronounces it, Harbor Master for the Richardson's Bay Regional Agency, which has been embroiled in a years-long battle with Sausalito's Anchorage, or Anchor Out, community, has announced he will resign at the end of the month after just 2 years on the job. Havel announced his departure in the agency's staff report for its upcoming October 14th meeting and noted he was leaving to pursue other career opportunities. It was not immediately clear who would replace him. I look forward to hearing about RBRA's, that's the Richardson Bay Regional Authority's, future successes as they transition vulnerable individuals into a safe, secure environment, you know, like crunching their boats and dumping people into a park from which they are immediately evicted by city authorities and only get to save it by going to court to get an injunction, but can't save their boats. That doesn't sound like a secure, safe environment to me, but promote and enhance the ecology of Richardson's Bay and manage the anchorage so it is a safe place that can be utilized as a true public commons, Havel wrote. Over the last 2 years, the RBRA and Havel in particular have become focal points in the escalating war between the agency, which oversees the estuary. This is Marin County right on the north shore of the San Francisco Bay. Have become focal points in the escalating war between the agency and a group of several dozen boaters who for years have been living freely and illegally on the water. They call themselves Anchor Outs. Richardson Bay only allows boaters to cruise into the estuary and stay for 72 hours. I know it sounds like the RV law in Santa Cruz. But over the decades, the area earned a reputation for being a laissez-faire anchorage where people stayed often for years. Some of the boaters have been there for as long as 50 years, and many of them didn't want to leave. When Havel joined the agency, his main objective was to clear the water of illegally moored vessels, which included destroying the boats. That led to a movement by Anchor Outs to protest what they said was unlawful destruction of property and cruel displacement that only intensified Sausalito's growing unhoused community. Havel told the Chronicle in June that by 2015, the number of illegal boats in the water had tripled from 90 to about 250. In the last 2 years, he added, he had personally removed and destroyed more than 120 vessels, which he alleged were mostly abandoned from the water and was determining how to move forward with the most complicated phase yet, removing the occupied boats. And looks like he's been removed instead, or at least he's resigning. Nice work up there, Robbie Paulson, and you others. And also a tip of the hat to Anthony Prince for his work in securing at least a temporary injunction and still apparently in negotiation, although the Anchor Outs have been forced to move from one of their survival encampments to another and then had that one reduced in size, but they're still struggling. And here's a story from the current Street Spirit, which you can actually get a copy of if you get to the Sub Rosa when it's actually open, or give me a call on the Huff line at 423-HUFF, or go to the library. You can read it there. I think we have a copy already in the library. It's the October issue of Street Spirit. Or you can go online in case you have access to a computer under thestreetspirit.org, I believe it is. Here's what this story well, it says, encampment residents fight for their rights in court, attracted my interest. Their victory is the first step in a case that could bolster the rights of unsheltered people with disabilities in California and beyond. Residents of the Ashby Shell Mound encampment, and then get that's up near Berkeley, argued they could not move into a congregate shelter because of their disabilities. The judge ruled in their favor, buying them 6 months before they have to leave the encampment. And the story continues. At the end of September, and that's last month, Berkeley-based advocacy group Where Do We Go, Berkeley, won a court battle to allow residents of the Shell Mound encampment community to stay put despite Caltrans' efforts to evict them. The preliminary injunction granted by District Court Judge by a district court judge means the group can continue living in their encampment next to the Ashby Shell Mound off-ramp for the next 6 months while they search for alternative housing. This is the third time WGB, where do we go, Berkeley, has taken to the courts to fight for the rights of encampment residents to shelter in their encampment when the city or state comes in to evict them. These suits come at a time when encampment sweeps in Bay Area cities are picking up after a brief pause during the COVID-19 pandemic, and the precedent set by these legal actions could have echoes across the state and beyond. People are starting to see lawsuits as a viable way to push back against some of the more questionable sweeps that cities in the state have been bringing. Ian Cordova Morales, the president and lead advocate of WDWGB, says they need to watch out because it's not just going to be us. The Ashby Shell Mound encampment sits at the very edge of town where Berkeley meets Emeryville. The border separating the two cities runs through the middle of the tents and self-built structures where some 27 people currently live. Many have been there for about 3 years. But in July, Caltrans started taking steps to close the encampment, citing concerns that the area is dirty and that the drivers need adequate space to regain control of their vehicles in the event of an accident. Additionally, a neighboring construction site had permits to use the land for emergency vehicle access. Back in July, the state agency posted a closure notice at the encampment, but could not ultimately follow through due to a temporary restraining order, a TRO, issued by a district court judge. They posted another closure notice last month, hoping to enact a closure on September 30th. Ahead of September 30th, outreach workers offered encampment residents spots at Horizon, a new Berkeley shelter on Grayson Street, where people live in tents indoors with access to amenities like showers and storage lockers. Sounds a little like the Veterans Hall before. I'm not sure if it's closed or not. I keep hearing conflicting stories here from that Santa Cruz shelter. However, the 11 unhoused plaintiffs argue that they have disabilities that make Horizon inaccessible to them. The group won on this Americans Disabilities Act claim, the ADA claim. The judge's ruling states that the plaintiffs proved they would suffer irreparable harm if their encampment was closed because without the shelter as an option, they would have no place else to go. In court, Caltrans argued that they are not able to mitigate the risks that arise when an encampment is located on state property and that allowing the group to stay would pose danger and exceed their power under the California Constitution as well as state and federal laws. You know, that there might be an accident at some point by a car going out of control and smashing into their encamp. Sounds like the trip and fall hazard claim used by Palo Alto some decades ago to pass a law that stopped homeless people from sitting down on the sidewalk, on a broad sidewalk in downtown Palo Alto. That is to say, it has nothing to do with real risks, but was simply a pretext to do it, to get rid of the homeless people downtown. In an email, a California representative said the agency has reviewed the written order and are considering legal options. This case is about people who are suffering with disabilities. It is not a preference that they can't go into congregate shelters, says Andrea Henson, one of the lawyers who worked on the suit. If they have to live by a freeway, they should say something about what they're suffering with. The unhoused plaintiffs suffer from clinical depression and anxiety, PTSD, bipolar disease, and other psychological disabilities that make congregate living impossible. One plaintiff explained to the judge that his experience in prison, where he was strip-searched 5 days a week for years and was once left naked in a holding cell with the lights off and his hands and feet tied together, has resulted in PTSD that is likely to be triggered by the specific dynamics of group living. Another plaintiff testified that her anxiety causes her to suffer in large groups of people. These are not simply discomforts, advocates argue, but rather legitimate health concerns that should be considered the same way that physical disabilities would be. Advocates say that encampment life allows people with disabilities to surround themselves with people who they feel comfortable with, and argue that closing an encampment harms unhoused people by cutting off their access to outreach providers and the self-built communities that keep them safe. WDWGB works to connect unhoused people to services that meet their needs and ultimately help them move indoors. Henson says that when the group formed in October 2019, they were working with about 160 people across four encampments. She says, Since then, some have disappeared and others have died, but many have been housed. Only 27 people of their original group still live outside. The folks who are left have severe mental and physical disabilities, traumas that most people can't even imagine, Henson said. That's why this is a victory for all those who suffer with disabilities and who, because of those disabilities, have been relegated to living on the street. The preliminary injunction that allows the group to stay in place for the next 6 months is not necessarily the end of the court battle. Caltrans has the opportunity to appeal it. If they do, they would bump the case up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where the decision would set precedent for 9 states, from Arizona to Montana, somewhat similar to the Boise versus Martin case. This court could have widespread policy implications. It would mean that judges in the Ninth Circuit courts would have to follow suit when similar cases come to bear. However, even if the case does not go to the Ninth Circuit Court, the legal implications of the WDWGB suit could be significant locally. If the advocacy organization continues to win in court, it could mean that Caltrans would need to accommodate unsheltered people with disabilities under the ADA when conducting encampment sweeps. It could fundamentally change the way that Caltrans, the state, and city governments have to do outreach before they do sweeps to make sure that the accommodations they have are fitting for people. Right now, options for shelter are one size fits all, says Cordova Morales. While these victories in the district court would not create a binding legal precedent, they would make it easier for unhoused people and attorneys in other places to argue similar cases in the future. And that's a story by Alistair Boone, editor-in-chief of Street Spirit in the October, I think it might actually come out in the November issue of Street Spirit, because it's dated October 7th. And I'm usually not a big fan, even though I pass it on to homeless people to sell, of the sort of revamped Street Spirit post Terry Messman, who was the previous editor of Street Spirit. But I'm glad she's covering this. Thank you, Alistair Boone, for covering this case. And I'm getting all these stories for those of you who are interested in keeping up with a lot of this stuff, which apparently Wes White is quite prolific in posting, as well as, of course, doing his own videoing. That's on the Monterey County Homeless Advocates Facebook page. Not a big fan of Facebook, because so much crap on it, but in some places you can find more than in other places. But I think we're a bit overdue for a musical break.
I came here to write something else, but then I got distracted. Sensory overload, now my thoughts are all impacted. You're all dressed in black, from your shoulders to your feet. But you put your hand upon my arm, such a friendly way to greet. Your blonde hair's in a bun, there are glasses on your face. They don't seem to match your studded belt, but you wear it all with grace. You're moving back and forth, but for a second you stand still, and I just feel the fluster. Then I feel the chill, the tattoos sparkle on your arms and on your neck. I think I can hear them call, and I just want to see them all. Are you always like this, with your eyes all aglow? Somehow each stud upon your belt says this might be so. Was there a moment you decided to become a work of art? Was it a way to light the darkness in your heart? The tattoos sparkle on your arms and on your neck. I think I can hear them call, and I just want to see them all. I guess I won't see you once I leave here today. I guess we'd never meet any other way. I don't think you like folk music. You won't be coming to my show. I'll just leave a tip upon the counter. It's probably time that I should go. The tattoos sparkle on your arms and on your neck. I think I can hear them call, and I just want to see them all. Thank you.
And I normally don't play a lot of love songs. It's not really a love song. It's just an appreciation of actually someone who he notes that he was just his waitress at Mama's Royal Cafe, which opened in Oakland in February 1974 and has been making, quote, delicious breakfasts ever since. Served by heavily tattooed, lovely people, last I checked. He was a regular there a long time ago. So next up is a conversation with Micah Posner, I mentioned before, who was probably the most liberal city council member about 10 years ago, which frankly wasn't saying much, and has since become more of an activist outside city council, or maybe he was in a different field than the one I spend my time in. I was always very frustrated with him for being what I felt was secretive in how he proceeded. And he nonetheless had a conversation with me, which I'm going to play, about a couple of the issues I think we both agree on, which is to say saving the Santa Cruz Community Credit Union building where it is, which he couldn't do, but he and others, Ron Pomerantz for one, tried to do. And I covered that a little bit on this show, as well as his concern about the fighting the downtown library burial under the parking garage. And he, of course, was actually out there on the streets organizing against the attempted eviction of the Riverside RVs that were parked in front of an abandoned or closed-up hotel or motel. Anyway, here's the interview, and make of it what you will. So I'm on the line with Micah Posner, who's a militant member of the Santa Cruz Community Credit Union. It's about 1:20 on October 18th. Hi, Micah.
Hi.
And you and others, Ron Pomerantz and other folks concerned with preserving the downtown location of the credit union, have been involved in a struggle and a signature gathering the last I saw some months ago to, shall we say, stop the board of directors from selling the building to, I don't know who, but what's the update on that?
So we got hundreds of members, probably like 400 members, to sign a petition saying we did not want the board to sell the property to a boutique hotel run out of New York called like Eagle Creek Hotels or something. And included in our request was to hold a special meeting about the issue, which we have the right to do based on the bylaws. Although we don't have the right to force the board to stop selling it, because according to the bylaws, we can hold a special meeting, but they're in charge of selling property. So, and we were kind of upset because really no members that we had talked to knew about this. You know, so the board says, well, we tried to tell people via this and that, and you know, maybe they did, but it didn't work. Like whoever's to blame, members really had no idea that they want to sell the building, especially to a hotel developer, as opposed to housing. So we had the special meeting. It was during the day. It was kind of hard to access. It was on Zoom, but still 100 people showed up, which is more than anyone ever shows up for a credit union meeting. And we took an advisory vote. We couldn't do a legally binding vote. We took an advisory vote, and 2-1, people asked them not to sell out to the hotel. And a few weeks later, they finished the deal and sold out to the hotel.
Is there any way to impeach or recall the members of the board?
There is, yeah. It's kind of a lot of work, though. So we thought about doing that before the property was sold. At this point, though, you know, we're still very disappointed with the leadership of the credit union, but it doesn't seem like a timely issue, and it's a lot of work to recall board members. So it is. So I'm thinking some of us are going to run for the board at the usual time, like in April. We need 100 signatures to do that. Although some of us are also considering just quitting the credit union. You know, it's sort of a question of, like, how much energy you put into something. I mean, clearly it's an institution gone awry. You know, it's really drifted from its mission of being member-owned and there for the community. So, you know, the question is how much energy do we put into getting it back on track. So I think I'm going to do it. I think I'm going to run for the board and you know, But anyways.
But you mean your experience with the city council hasn't educated you on the futility of that kind of approach?
Well, if you're discouraging me, I'll just go to Bay Federal. Like, what do you think, Robert? You know, should we try to...
Well, I don't know about Bay Federal either. I mean, I know that every time I've...
I gotta go to some bay.
Yeah, well, you got your pillow and your mattress, don't forget.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm a member of the credit union, too, still. So, you know, I'm hardly one to, you know, chastise you. You actually have been doing active work to try to actually try to, you know, get this issue stopped. Although, you know, I mean, it seemed to me that when... You know, when they were being unresponsive, you needed to do more direct action, like occupy the goddamn lobby or something, because they were not.
In hindsight, I guess you were right. Like I had an assumption that the board cared what members thought, which
no,
mostly not to be true.
Well, the problem with that is, you see, you may know good people who are on the board, but the board becomes a power unto itself, and it corrupts.
Exactly, right.
It corrupts those who do it. They don't look like they're.
The board wouldn't even talk to us. Like, you know, now they've issued this whole. This whole piece, their latest email is this whole explanation, you know, why they did it. And, you know, I mean, that's reasonable. It's fine. They have their reasons. But, you know, what's really patronizing and crummy is that they issued this after they finished the sale. Like, we were asking them for months, like, what's going on? And can you get out of it? And what's, you know, what's this? What's that? And they completely refused to talk to us. And then after it's done, they issue all their reasoning, you know, so...
Well, you see, you keep hoping that within the power structure there can be some kind of reason, but within the power structure there's power, is what there is. See, that's the problem, and you know, and though it's anyway, I mean, I found
I'm arguing with you today, Robert.
What's that? Yeah, you're not arguing today. I know, but it's too late. It's too late. That's the problem. You know, I mean,
there's no chance of stopping the hotel, though. I'd love to tell your listeners about that.
Okay, let's hear more about that.
Because we did. With the help of an attorney, we did find a law, which makes a lot of sense. It says that if the city is going to sell property without a usual process, you know, to individuals, then there has to be a finding about how that fits in with the city's general plan, you know, which makes sense because, like, otherwise you could just sell property to your friend, you know. So that issue is going to come either to the Planning Commission and or the City Council. The latest I hear, it's going to come to the City Council, like, in December. So that'd be a great opportunity for people to come. It'd be the first time. So this whole hotel sale thing has been organized by city staff and a group of old boy developers all behind closed doors for years now and never had a full public hearing. So I think because of this law, we're finally going to have a public hearing where people can come and you know, express whether they wanted, you know, a boutique hotel in downtown Santa Cruz or whether they'd rather have housing.
You know, and my reaction to that is similar to the reaction I had when, you know, although I don't recall whether I suggested the lobby occupation idea when we talked before, but it's similar in the sense that I think what you're, a lot of people are concerned with the gentrification of downtown generally, including the library business and so forth. I would say, rather than sit around with your fingers crossed and your head up your ass, waiting for the city council to, you know, to do something and the staff to respond, which is, you know, I think it's clear what they're trying to do, and they'll be trying to use every way to thwart you. You go to the community directly with mass meetings, and I mean even in-person meetings, masked but distanced meetings if necessary, where you can get some real political power, you know, and whether it be to, you know, recall Donna Myers or, you know, whatever the hell it involves, instead you actually, or just to block that, this one particular sale. I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, developments that are, I understand, happening, although I am really ignorant of the specifics of these actions. Maybe you want to talk more about this hotel sale, and let me ask you first, how long have you been a member of the Community Credit Union?
Oh, like 35 years.
And you clearly had a different expectation as to how they'd respond. Although, did you notice a change in the last decade in how the Community Credit Union has been behaving in terms of member requests and member services and so forth?
I hadn't noticed it. Since we started this conversation, a lot of people have said, oh, yeah, it's totally different. They've really gone, you know, corporate, but I didn't notice it. No, I mean, they've always treated me really well personally as far as giving me loans and stuff, you know. It's just that, in hindsight, you know, they become more and more internally focused on their own bottom line.
I mean, I know what I noticed is I wanted to find out where their investments were going and where my money was being invested. And I repeatedly requested specifics and a report on this, and they either put me off or they gave me the broadest and vaguest possible description. And I also noticed they're charging you. If you want to get your back records, for example, suppose you want to find a check that happened a couple of years ago, they will charge you $5 per month. For every, if you wanted to get, you know, usually, you know, it's, and this is for email. We're not talking about a printed activity. In email, if I wanted to, I was trying to find a payment back in 5 years ago, they were going to charge me $200 to find that. You know, it's.
Yeah, I can't speak to that. I mean, I don't really.
I don't know either. I know, though, that when.
You think too, you know, but I don't know how good or bad they are, like, serving
there. No, I'm speaking to it myself. I mean, I'm that's my experience, which I think is, you know, it shows clearly that it has nothing to do with the costs and time and energy of actually just, you know, here's your bank records for the last 5 years. It's on this computer. You know, it's more here's how we can make some more money off of you in a ridiculous way. Now, I just wondered if that had changed in terms of whether you're telling me that you haven't noticed it, but others have, is what you're saying. Not necessarily.
Well, now I notice. I mean, now that I've tried to interact with the board, I mean, clearly they've changed their idea about what the credit union is to be more of sort of a corporate charity, you know, where it's like they want to do good things for some part of the community, but they don't care what the members think, you know. It's not really a member-owned institution. And the way to resolve that is to have a different board, which is why we're thinking about doing that. It's just a little tiring, you know, to continually have to.
Now, is it a different board, or have things been changed in the last 10 or 15 or 20 years so that there's a structure which allows an influential faction to rule things, as, for example, is the case in KPFA, as I understand it, so.
I don't know. My experience with city council is that the staff run things, you know, as a corporation to get money, and this council lets them get away with it. So my guess is that's what's been happening to the board. They haven't really been safeguarding it as a democratic institution. And they could, you know, if the board cared enough to do so.
If you wanted, I mean, if you were to look around Santa Cruz, do you have any other sense of other gentrification developments happening that you would comment on happening in the last year?
Well, it hasn't happened yet, but the hotel proposal is nick and knack. It's a twin with the parking garage, because the hotel would require, when it was full, which would be about a third of the time, it would require 180 subsidized city parking spaces, which would be about half of the parking spaces they want to build at the farmer's market, which would be a subsidy to the hotel of about $700,000 a year, because it's $1.4 million to build the hotel. But, you know, it's hard to say how you exactly count that. But the point is that the parking garage is being built in part to support the hotel. So those projects are joined at the hip.
And we're talking, for those who don't know, because we're dealing with an audience that usually focuses on homeless issues, the proposal to use library funding to essentially move the library under a six- or five-story parking garage, which will be placed at the current location of the farmer's market, right?
Right. And city revenue, specifically from the parking fund, would be used to subsidize the garage. It would lose approximately $1.4 million a year. And then a lot of those spots that were subsidizing would be used by hotel guests.
Wow. And on a completely different topic, although is there more on this topic that you think we should know about that happened recently?
Yeah, there's an initiative that's being launched, I believe, on October 21st, I think, if they get all the legal paperwork done, called Our Downtown, Our Future, which would stop the parking garage. And it would be a cool thing, because it would generally be a statement against backroom deals and gentrification.
And there's no way an initiative can stop the Santa Cruz Community Credit Union's sellout to the New York Hotel. What about the issue above the somehow stopping the Santa Cruz Community Credit Union hotel sellout?
We can't. They finished the deal.
And there's no way to reverse it through some kind of indication of improper influence or improper procedure?
No.
And you know this because you've researched it pretty thoroughly? Say that again?
We hired a lawyer.
So it's the lawyer name. Yeah, well. So, another issue that you and I talked about relatively recently, in fact, we saw each other, the last time we saw each other was, I think, there at the Riverside Drive, or maybe it was a little later. But Riverside had two people in vehicles who were living there that the Public Works Department and the Police Department seemed to be colluding to, that's from my perspective as I understand it, to drive away, and that's next to a sort of a defunct hotel that... anyway, there was...
I gotta get going, Robert, so let's wrap it up with this one.
Okay. So I'm looking to get some kind of sense of this. Any news from those folks who you defended, you and others from the neighborhood defended from eviction?
Yeah, there's been some issues. So the neighbor that's been working with the police to try to get rid of them, he got upset again because people that lived there in their vehicles were bagging their trash but just leaving it on the sidewalk. So we tried to talk to some people. We didn't really get much response, and then we took the trash over to the nearest trash can. But that's kind of a bummer. It'd be great if people could take care of their own trash. So, you know, it's an ongoing thing where, you know, we want people to be able to live there, and we want them to be good neighbors.
How long ago did this recent event happen, this recent problem?
About 3 or 4 weeks ago.
And so, but as far as, do you know if they're still living there, or has it changed?
I know people are still living there, for sure.
So the,
they can't drive them off now. That's what they tried to do, was to change the parking so people couldn't live there, but we stopped them, so people are still living there.
Well, there is also I know you've got to go. There's a 72-hour storage law, which means they have to move them. So they can move if they want, but right now they've chosen to stay there.
Oh, people move. They move. You know, they move a few spaces, or they go away for a few days to come back.
Thank you. Then I appreciate you taking the time, and we'll be playing it on Thursday.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Time to leave now, from Hobart to Antarctica. So close but so far from Australia, where watchful eyes are always peeled, 'cause you never know when there's a growler below. Watchful eyes peeled for predators and prey, where all you can do is whatever you can to keep the hunt at bay. Time is coming, and it's coming soon, when we'll stand between you and that harpoon. Tide is unforgiving, the seafloor is a grave, for those capsized before us fell beneath the waves. Perhaps we'll join them by accident or not, a gale or a storm or a well-aimed shot. But we'll steer around the ice and right into their sights. Everyone must pick their battles, this is our fight. So here beneath the Southern Cross and the crescent moon, we'll stand between you and that harpoon. Between you and the harpoon, there's just a little space, but that's where we can see your face. Look into your eyes, hear you sing. One comes to realize you have to do something. Sometimes all you can do is do your best and hope that someone else will do the rest. So once again, we'll spend this afternoon standing between you and that harpoon.
And that was Between You and That Harpoon. And what David Rovix writes is, on February 6, 1980, Sea Shepherd operatives sank a Norwegian whaling ship in Lisbon Harbor. They would go on to sink other whaling ships and generally to make life difficult for whalers around the world. And next up is Monica Martella of Petaluma. You may have heard, well, you probably did if you're listening to the earlier part of the show, that Petaluma activists, plaintiffs, homeless, unhoused people, got an injunction forestalling action by Petaluma authorities to remove their encampment. And I don't have a lot of detail. I'm hoping to have more. And Monica herself seemed to be somewhat, as I remember, scanty on the details. But she talks about her life and her feelings about the situation, and, well, here she is.
So today is the 17th of October, and it's around 2:15. I just got a call from Monica how do I pronounce your last name, Monica? Yeah, you too.
Sorry if I'm in a bad area.
Yeah, it's a crappy connection, but that's okay. So, how do we pronounce your last name?
Martella. It's M-A-R-T-E-L-L-A.
Gotcha. And you've been kind of an active presence on Facebook, and we've kind of communicated a little bit through messaging there and emailing, and I was particularly encouraged to hear that a number of the plaintiffs, is it, what's the name of the park we're talking about? Steamboat Lane? Is that it?
No, it's Steamer Landing.
Thank you. Steamer Landing.
Yeah.
It's Steamer Landing. Have they filed their own injunction and gotten it without an attorney, and now they have an attorney? Is that what's happening?
I believe so. They did have assistance from Sonoma County Legal Aid in filing the injunction, but now they do have an attorney involved.
Uh-huh. And you yourself are outside?
I am not outside anymore. I was evicted in June from my spot, which was not in Steamer Landing Park, but it was in it was on Sonoma County land.
And so, but you were evicted from your spot, but you were, have you made your way indoors since?
I rent a room now. I got my stimulus, and we got a tax refund, me and my ex. So that enabled me to get into a bedroom.
I imagine that's helped a little, huh?
It's kind of complicated. I wish that I had a short answer to that question, but things have gone downhill since then, to tell you the truth, to be honest with you. I wish that instead of a room or the government's version of acceptable housing, that we would have made progress with some equity in this city.
What does that mean to get to make progress with equity in the city?
That we could have stopped the harassment coming from the government, especially the police, against unhoused people. And the deprivation is terrible. Like they told the public that there would be showers coming, and then there's been no showers. So there's a couple different ways to take a shower in Petaluma, and they both involve pretty much checking your human rights at the door and accepting condescending treatment, possibly not getting a shower at all because you're not welcome on the property, and stuff like that. So I just wish that there, you know, we could have accomplished more.
Let me interrupt you, Monica. What has the injunction accomplished so far, would you say, if anything?
It has stopped the police from sweeping this community out of the private part of Steamer Landing Park. The property lines are really complicated in that piece of land. And part of it is, it's at least claimed to be private. So the private part is being swept. At this point, Legal Aid is trying to encourage the residents to go to the public side of the property, even though it's within 100 feet of water, which has been held against unhoused people before, too, and used as an excuse to displace them. They're still being encouraged to go toward the water, which is supposedly the public side of the property, but
they're still vulnerable. They're still vulnerable there, I guess is what you're saying, huh?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. They've been in the past removed from there and harassed there also.
So this Judge Chen, who has issued the injunction and has a hearing coming up at the end of the month, what do you make of him?
I don't know anything about them individually.
I understand. What do you make of the delineation of the injunction? What do you make of what the injunction says? How does it help if it does?
I think it has helped because there's been I really should check in with the community before I answer that question, because there have been police by, but there was a fight, that's why. There was a reason. But this is the first injunction that's been that I've heard of in Petaluma on behalf of unhoused people. I've been living here for 4 years, and I'm just hoping. I don't think that I wish I had more optimism, but I do wish that it would open the door to stronger defense of human rights.
So
in Petaluma,
how many people does the injunction impact at Steamer Lane?
I estimate it about 35.
And how many people do you estimate who are unhoused in the Petaluma area?
The last estimate that I read was actually 300.
And how are the those beyond the 35? How are the 300 being treated? Has the injunction impacted them at all?
I don't think so. I think it's just strictly this community at Steamer Landing Park. In general, I can tell you that I was displaced from numerous places in Petaluma when I first moved here, so it didn't seem to make any difference where I went until finally I ended up at the fairgrounds for months. They left me alone there. That ended too, but not with the police. It was the one that somebody else got involved in. But I don't really keep in contact with other unhoused just because I don't see them. I work full time and
What kind of a job do you do?
I work at UPS. I'm a package handler.
How are they treating you there?
They treat me great. They're awesome. Honestly, I could not ask for a better work situation.
How is your
how we're treated?
How's your connection with other workers?
What? I'm sorry.
Do you have much social connection with other workers off the job?
No. No.
Because you're too exhausted to do anything, or because there's your preference or some discrimination, or, and by the way, you don't have to answer.
Oh, no, not at all. It is an exhausting job. It's very physically demanding, but that's what I want. I'm kind of addicted to that because it really helps with my depression to just stay really active as much as I can.
I got you. So, when you talked about your initially, when we started talking, you mentioned that you would really have preferred to see a more equitable settlement rather than just your being able to move indoors and maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, this Steamer Lane people getting some temporary protection on part of the property they're on, that doesn't impact the great majority of homeless people or houseless people outside. Am I properly stating this?
Yeah, that's correct. And I wanted to add something if I could.
Sure.
I know what I need, and I don't need to live in a house, and I actually don't want to live in a house. And what's happening right now is that I've had to go into this bedroom that I don't really need to keep the government from continuing to harass me and displace me. So I think if the government really cared about people's well-being, especially poor people, they would lift the camping ban and establish places where people could live outside. Because this bedroom that I got right now, somebody else needs this, and they're not getting it. So, as far as equity and stuff is concerned, like, part of that is assessing people's actual needs, not what the establishment considers their needs to be, because they never ask and they never listen.
You're not doing a cookie-cutter approach.
Exactly.
So, is it mainly because of your concern for other people, or do you feel that you, if everybody else had everything they needed, you would choose to be outside as well, simply because you prefer it that way?
There is that too. That's true. I'm going to be honest about that. I feel healthier when I'm closer to the ground, when I'm breathing the air outside, when I'm around trees and stuff. And that's been taken from everybody, really. That's the only people that can camp in this area legally are rich people. Because the few campgrounds charge like $80 a night and up, and you can't stay anywhere for longer than a week at a time, if I remember right. It's not right.
Sounds typical, yeah. No, it's the usual bullshit.
Man, I'm sorry, you're breaking up.
No, I say it's the usual bullshit. That's the, you need plastic to get in, and you can only do it for a limited time. Can you still hear me?
I heard the "can you still hear me" part.
Okay, well, that's good. That's the beginning. So I know that down here in Santa Cruz, people some time ago who are outside would migrate to the parks during the winter when they were closed, but then the restrictions became tighter and tighter, not just the cost of being in the park, but the state park system started ruling that you couldn't be there for more than a week, but you couldn't return. You only have a certain amount of time per year. I don't know what the current situation is, but it's It's designed to exclude people who engage in survival camping in the park. Did you hear what I said?
No, you're pretty broken up, but I did catch the part where the state parks are even more restricting the camping. And that was pretty much all I caught. I'm sorry.
It's designed to cut back on survival camping. It's designed to make sure that people don't use the parks to survive and to exist in, because therefore they're the playgrounds, as you say, of the rich, or at least those who have money.
Exactly.
And now a brief interruption, musical of course, and then we'll return to Monica Martella.
He's in Germany, and this year was Germany, and that was like 52. Force sued the U.S. Army, the U.S. government, in the 50s, because during the war, the U.S. Air Force bombed their tank-making facilities in Germany. And this is true. And what was it, like 52 or something? They sued the U.S. government for destroying their factories. And they won. They won the lawsuit. So I had to write a little song for Henry here.
Ford built tanks for the Nazis, and the Nazis used those tanks to gun down lots of soldiers in the U.S. Army ranks. Yes, Henry Ford was a fascist, and a nasty one was he. He built tanks for anyone for the proper fee. Henry Ford spoke to his lackeys, and he said, "Isn't this great? We'll attack our enemies, and we'll retaliate." Yes, Henry Ford was a fascist and a cunning liar, too. A brown shirt with a swastika draped in red, white, and blue. Henry Ford spoke to his workers and he said, "You dare not strike. You must be patriotic and take on my Third Reich." Yes, Henry Ford was a fascist and he had not a care about the dying soldiers that made him a billionaire. Ford built tanks for the Nazis, and he built many more to gun down lots of peasants in Peru and Salvador. Yes, Henry Ford was a fascist, I heard that when he died. The last words to leave his lips was Arbeit macht frei. Yes, the dollar was his icon on whichever shore, and Henry's only motto was make money and make war. Yes, Henry Ford was a fascist, that's all I have to say. I will spit on Henry's rotting grave until my dying day. Yes, Henry Ford was a fascist, that's all I have to say. I will spit on Henry's rotting grave until my dying day.
And David Rovics writes further, in February 1974, the Ford Motor Company's Nazi ties were revealed in a Senate report. For Henry Ford and his company, ties with the Nazis were numerous and complex. Ford was a believer in the pseudoscience of eugenics and was a firm believer in white supremacy and the inferiority of other races. He funded pro-Nazi speaking tours around the U.S. in the 1930s, was quoted by Hitler, and profited massively from both sides of the war, building cars and tanks in both Michigan and Germany. Just as Coke changed their name to Fanta for sales within Germany, Ford changed their name to Opel. Perhaps the most shocking part of this whole saga is how Ford sued the U.S. government for damages for bombing some of their tank factories in Germany, and they won.
Yeah.
So are you talking to me? Are you calling from your house now or your room?
No, I'm actually walking because I'm going to get a stove cartridge for a friend. Can you hear me okay with the cars? I'm sorry.
I can. I mean, there's an interest.
Okay. I'm gonna start walking. I was getting the signal there, but if it's too loud for you,
either way is fine. You're good. You can go. Okay. You can walk, you can stand, whatever sounds good.
Cool. Okay.
Now, do you do much writing, Monica?
you. I'm sorry.
No, no, it's okay. Do you do much writing? You write?
Yeah, I write all the time, especially now.
And do you post it online? You post it online?
Did you ask if I post online?
Yes.
Right now, like, I've been off Facebook for at least 3 weeks because I felt that I was just venting, like, hate and anger, and that's not a direction I want to go in anymore. I don't know how to manage it right now, to tell you the truth.
Gotcha.
So, I want to use Facebook only for good, and until I can figure out how to do that and kind of get control of myself on that, I'm just going to stay off. And it's a really hard decision because you can do a lot of good on Facebook if you do have the self-control.
So is there any of your earlier writings you would recommend people read to understand the Petaluma situation?
There's a lot of stuff that was on my profile, but it's probably gone now. And no, I don't have anything specific. I'm sorry.
Any recommendations of places people can go to get more info about Petaluma's folks outside?
Porchlight Coalition's website and their Facebook page.
Say that again.
Porchlight Coalition.
Porchlight Coalition.
Yeah. Their Facebook page and their website. And also PAM Equity.
What equity?
PAM. T-A-M. It's short for Tamil Pious.
Oh, T as in Thomas, A-M?
Yeah.
Tam Equity.
In Marin County and Sausalito.
Oh, yeah. I think I saw that for the first time the other day, so it's interesting.
Yeah, they're doing a lot of good work.
You have any connection with other activists in the California Homeless Union, like, you know, Robbie Powelson and Jason Soros?
Yeah, Robbie Powelson and Crystal Rose Sanchez. Like, I haven't met her in person, but I've been following her work and trying to be supportive. And, So, she's doing great stuff for the California Homeless Union in Sacramento. And she initiated the Steinberg recall effort, which unfortunately didn't work. But hopefully we can disempower that guy.
Steinberg is the Sacramento mayor?
Correct. And he's also the chairman of the Committee on Homelessness. It's a state position that Newsom appointed him to, and he has abused his power, and he's responsible for at least 7 deaths of unhoused in Sacramento because of the power he's been given for both of his positions, which he abuses.
And remind us of how that happened.
How? He refused to open a warming center. That was part of it. I don't know the specific numbers and circumstances of the deaths, but I know there were 7 that are pretty much on his negligence and his refusal to provide basic sanitation, basic needs for residents of Sacramento that are unhoused.
What allies do homeless people in Petaluma have? Who are they?
They are me, Monica Martella, and Lucky Oaks. That's O-A-K-S. I hope I'm spelling it right. Yasha Talam. That's T-A-L-A-M. And Ronan Vanderlyn. That's R-O-N-A-N-V-A-N.
And these are people, they have Facebook pages, or they have websites, or they have... Are they just...
Yasha and I are not personally operating on Facebook right now, but we are Porch Light Coalition.
I gotcha. So if somebody came to Petaluma, they should try to reach you by phone if they wanted to get in touch?
Yeah. And the best thing right now is I don't have the hotline number with me, which is embarrassing. But there is a phone that we have for Porch Light, but I'd be happy to give you my number. If they specifically needed help in Petaluma and they're unhoused, I'm okay with you giving them my number.
You want me to put that out or not?
If you could have them contact you first.
I gotcha. Hang on a second. I'm going to pause.
Yeah.
Hang on. So back to that. I got your number, and I will check probably this audio later to get the names you've given me, which are everything you've said so far, with the exception of that phone number, is it will be archived publicly unless you don't want that to happen.
I should probably check with them just in case, but I think they're okay with it. But if you could let me check with them,
sure,
that would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, just let me know before Thursday if you can, if there's a parts of this you want me to keep private.
Okay, I can do that.
Sounds good. Anything you want to know from me?
No, I just want to thank you for everything you do on behalf of unhoused people, and thank you especially for the information. And you have a uniting effect on the movement, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I could be a pretty sharp critic too, but I appreciate your saying that. You know, if that's true, it's great. You know, and of course, I'm not. I'm just sort of a housed liberal. You know, I'm in no way.
Yeah, but that's cool. I mean, that's okay. I mean,
yeah. Okay. I mean, there are a lot of people.
You're an ally, and I appreciate your support.
Well, insofar as it, you know, simply playing you, you know, it sounds like you're the one who's putting out the energy, fighting depression, fighting difficult circumstances at the same time, and, you know, you're the one who's putting out the energy. I mean, I'm taking it in on the phone, and that's very nice, but, you know, good for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and so forth. Well, I don't know. Listen, if you are you able to call me at different times if you need to, you can. If you got more reports, you're welcome to call in, or, you know, inquiries or whatever. I don't know much I can tell you. You're the one who's on the scene.
Okay. Yeah, I will.
But yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, sure. And if there are updates, I mean, I'd like to know are you going to be following this injunction?
Yeah, I'm going to try to make it out there on the 28th and just see if there's anything that I can do to help my neighbors, and try to keep track of them. They're my friends, too. And so I'm going to...
Do you have any phone contact with any of the plaintiffs?
Unfortunately, there's one that has a phone, and I text him, but he doesn't really text back. He's a better, he's better about communicating in person, so I do see him once or twice a week.
Well, you can text him and tell him that I'd love to get an interview with him if he's up for it, and if that's okay... But you say it's not really easy to reach him by phone. You know, have him call me, or I'll call him, or something.
Okay. Well, he's the one I'm going to take the cartridge to. So if he's there, I'll ask him if he's okay with an interview with you.
Sounds good. Have him call me, And I will, and we'll do it, you know, this afternoon if he feels like it. Otherwise, you know, unless it's interfering with what you guys are doing.
No, that would be great. I'll pass that on to him. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I do too. Okay.
All right.
Well,
thank you, Robert.
Hey, you hang in there. And, it sounds like you're in the middle of a blizzard up there, but
this damn wind. So yeah, I wish I could have held still for this, but I kind of got behind on everything. So
you're okay. No problem. Yeah, stay in touch if you feel like it, and this will be coming out on Thursday on Free Radio's net. We're not on the radio, we're on the net right now, but that's what we're doing.
And that was our windy interview with Monica Martella. Music now, and then a flashback.
President came to London, was greeted by the Queen. For the people of the city, it was a festive scene. Hundreds of thousands of women and men were all in the street, shouting and dancing and talking and marching on their feet. But the highest peak of the evening, to be only fair, was when the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square. Those days in London was the place to be. Young and old, black and white, was the face of society. Even the mayor came out, called him a criminal of war. Said world domination ain't worth fighting for. They said we don't like W or his poodle Tony Blair. On the day the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square, the night sky was lit up and the message, it was clear. We do not want fascism over there or over here. It was heard firsthand by many right there on British soil. We will not fight for Exxon. We won't kill or die for oil. But for billions around the planet, we were all right there. When the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square. When the statue of George Bush was toppled in Trafalgar Square.
And that was a statue toppling that I never heard about and never saw on the boob tube or anywhere else. But here's what David Rovics writes about his song. February 15, 2003 was judged by many to be the biggest single global day of protest here on planet Earth up until that time. An estimated 13 million people demonstrated in towns and cities across the world against U.S. plans to attack Iraq. I sang at the protest in New York City. That's David Rovics. I heard about the one in London, which is what this song is about. The war, of course, went on ahead the following month, leading to the devastation and destabilization of an entire region and causing millions to lose their lives and millions more to become refugees, which in so many cases is just a somewhat slower way to lose one's life than being shot or bombed. And while we're at the Iraqi war, let's not forget the recent death by COVID of Colin Powell, who gets headlined in the papers as some kind of a hero, statesman and general. Here's another view that kind of accords with mine. Powell lied, people died. Justice delayed was justice denied, by Thomas Knapp. On October 19th, 96-year-old Irmgard Furchner appeared in a German court to answer charges of abetting and aiding, or aiding and abetting, 11,412 murders. The murders took place between 1943 and 1945 at the Stutthof concentration camp, where a much younger Furchner worked as secretary to the camp's commandant. A day before Furchner's indictment, Colin Powell, the U.S. government's 16th National Security Advisor, 12th Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and 65th Secretary of State, died at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center from complications related to COVID-19. 76 years after the end of World War II, governments are rounding up the last few living Nazi war criminals, nonagenarians, and even centenarians who played minor roles in the Holocaust, and hauling them into court for their crimes against humanity. 18 years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the ringleaders of that crime against humanity, are beginning to die off in bed, surrounded by their loved ones, eulogized in the press as leaders and statesmen. Powell was preceded in death this year by former U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. The process of seeking justice for the victims of Nazism has been long, difficult, and spotty in application, but at least it's still being pursued. The process of seeking justice for the victims of Powell, Rumsfeld, and other architects of the Iraq War, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, thousands of U.S. troops, hasn't even begun. Like Powell, Rumsfeld lied to the American public and to the world about Saddam Hussein's supposed weapons of mass destruction, providing a pretext for war as trumped up as Hitler's excuse for Germany's 1939 invasion of Poland. Iraqi journalist Muntadhar El-Zadi, famous for throwing his shoes at then-President George W. Bush during a 2008 Baghdad press conference, puts it bluntly. Quote, "I am saddened by the death of Colin Powell without his being tried for his crimes in Iraq, but I am sure that the court of God will be waiting for him." Assurances of a final judgment in the afterlife aside, Powell's life since 2003 has been a case of justice delayed, his death a case of justice denied. Other Iraqi war criminals, however, remain at large. Bush fancies himself an artist these days when he's not hobnobbing with Ellen DeGeneres at a football games. I apologize for Ellen's name. I'm pretty sure I'm garbling it. Former National Security Advisor and Powell's successor as Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, teaches at Stanford. Former U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz went on to head the World Bank and currently enjoys a sinecure at the American Enterprise Institute. And there are others. They're not paying for their crimes. They're not absconding to non-extradition countries one step ahead of arrest and trial. They're enjoying the good life, seemingly unworried at the prospect of even facing justice. That's something that can and should change. That's a story by Thomas Knapp on the antiwar.com website. And it's entitled, Powell Lied, People Died, Justice Delayed Was Justice Denied. So coming up next is another flashback of a program on KCBS, I guess it is, called Nightbeat. And it has to do with, it interviews Marion Standish, who's the executive director of the California Rural Legal Assistance Group, where she's sort of holding her own against the people who are denouncing the woeful visible homeless and panhandlers, and at the same time wringing their hands and saying how really concerned we all are, but aren't these panhandlers, you know, making lots of money every day? And I admit it, you don't really believe them, do you? That seems to be, as far as I can see, the attitude that's here. And she kind of presents an alternate view. This all happened back in, I think it was either 1989 or even 1988. It's part of a Master Food Not Bombs compilation I made. That is to say, stuff that in different audio clips that involved legal issues, news analysis, discussion of the attacks on food servers and, I guess, homeless people generally, but particularly focusing on food not bombs. And food not bombs is mentioned in here, but it's actually broader. But here it is for what it's worth. Enjoy it if you can. It's 30 years old, at least. And it's, unfortunately, a lot of these attitudes are still there, or worse attitudes, as the situation intensifies, becomes more visible. At the same time, because it's more visible, it's harder to deny and harder to fabricate. But people are more frightened and apprehensive and more prone to accept mythologies about homeless people. So there's a kind of a double-edged sword there. Anyway, here we go. Let me just conclude, though, before we end this, because this is the end of my current discussion. If you want to reach me, as regular listeners know, you can contact me at the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line at 831-423-4833, and I welcome news breaks. Interested people want to talking about issues that I'm discussing on this show, which where you think you have some relevant information, or you've had personal experiences that you think bear on this, or you've seen examples of discrimination recently and abuse that you think need to be highlighted, or alternately, some really positive stuff that I don't focus on the positive, I acknowledge that, but I do occasionally get into it, and I'd be happy to, if I get some initiative and contact from folks who are interested in discussing this, I'd like some good news. That would be good. Again, the number is 831-423-4833.